Welcome to What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. This is your invitation to meet the faculty dedicated to understanding our most complex organ, committed to curing mental illness, and inspired to help create a healthier, thriving world. We're so glad you've joined us once again on What Makes Up Your Mind. I'm Jane McMillan. This episode offers a lifeline to anyone experiencing the heartbreak of substance use, whether the person themselves grappling with the addiction, but also, and in particular, those who love and are worried about them. Our guest is Dr. Karen Osilla, a licensed clinical psychologist and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. In her lab and in her practice, focusing on opioid use disorder, Dr. Osilla is researching and utilizing an approach called CRAFT, Community Reinforcement Approach and Family Training. Results are exciting. Science and human results show CRAFT works, and it's applicable to any unhealthy substance use scenario. The CRAFT program is for family and friends impacted by the substance use of their loved one, those whom Dr. Osilla says are the faceless, often forgotten sufferers in this tragedy. Unlike traditional tough love approaches, CRAFT is based on empathy as a communication strategy. It's designed to strengthen family connections. Its tools for positive contingencies provide powerful encouragement for the loved one to accept treatment, while, importantly, helping those around them maintain their own well-being and sense of equilibrium in what is often in these circumstances a fraught relationship. Now, all of this is best explained by Dr. Osilla herself in her very warm and caring way. Dr. Osilla, it's wonderful to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Let's talk about the overall picture of your work. What do you see as the challenge for the loved ones of those who are addicted as you are informed by it and it inspires your work?
We know a lot about the volumes of people who are experiencing opioid use disorder. And more recently, we're starting to learn a little bit more about the family members affected by opioid use disorder as well. We have colleagues at RAND, Allison Athey and her group, recently published a paper showing about around 40 million people, US Americans, have had their lives disrupted by losing someone just to overdose. And so you think about the volumes of family members that are affected by opioid use currently with their loved ones. So I think the big picture for me and what I've dedicated a lot of my research to are these forgotten faces, these people that we don't talk about who are experiencing the pain and struggle and strife associated with their loved ones' opioid use.
And you mentioned that statistic. Those are the people affected by the death of a loved one. And so the countless others who are living with the sadness and frustration and anger and guilt and fear of those who are currently addicted.
Yeah, the volumes of people. And I think as a profession, we need to be ready for this new wave of people who statistically tend not to seek help because of the stigma, the shame, the blame, all those feelings that you just mentioned that are associated with substance use.
The treatment protocol that you're using, working with now and studying the results of, is called CRAFT. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. CRAFT is an approach that was developed by Jane Ellen Smith and Robert Myers at the University of New Mexico, who have really done a fine job of developing an evidence-based therapy for the family member. And the goal of CRAFT is to help family members who have a loved one that doesn't want to go to treatment for whatever reason, is ambivalent and struggling with help seeking. And the goals of CRAFT are really to help the family member develop better compassion and understanding for why the loved one is using substances. The ultimate goal of CRAFT is to foster connection between the family member and the loved one. Because what often happens is when family members are experiencing pain and struggle, it puts distance between them and the loved one, and they focus mostly on the negative things and the consequences that are happening. So the goals of CRAFT are really to better understand why the loved one is using their substances, to build that empathy, that compassion, as well as helping the loved one improve their communication and the timing of their communication to, again, foster that connection. And ultimately, we hope that in CRAFT, by learning those principles, that we give support to the family member as well, you know, in terms of coping with the mental health symptoms that they may be experiencing.
But it's different than some of the tough love approaches that we traditionally hear about or read about or experience ourselves. One of the things that you sent to me to help me prepare for this conversation was a story by a woman named Barbara. Would you share that with us?
Sure. Barbara is part of our research team on a project called Inspire that I can share more about. And Barbara recently published an article of her lived experience in the Journal of Substance Use and Addiction Treatment that details her lived experience as a mom and her journey, her roller coaster with her son who uses substances, who is doing really well, by the way. And in that article, she talks about how she sought different providers and sought different advice about how to interact with her son in the peaks of his substance use and mental health issues. A lot of the first touches with the system, with service providers, was to use a tough love approach, not answer the calls, to lock the door. And she found that that essence was not part of her core values. She didn't feel the connectedness that she longed to do and longed to express to her son. And so she found CRAFT. She found an alternative to the tough love approach. She learned more about why her son was using. He was struggling with a lot of overstimulation associated with neurodivergence and needed the substances to calm down. She developed this understanding, this compassion. She worked with her son to build reinforcers in the community. He loved music. And she worked with him to increase those non-substance using activities that brought so much joy to him and so much relief, to increase that connection, increase that understanding of what brought joy to him. So in that process of using CRAFT with her son, she found this new connection with him, and they're closer than ever. He's doing extremely well, and she's learned to communicate with her son in ways that she's never before.
Let's talk about some specifics then, because it sounds like a wonderful scenario, but the nuts and bolts of loving an addicted person is never clear-cut. It's hard forging a connection. Let's start with that. It is difficult to forge a connection with someone who may not be themselves at any given moment because they are using.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? How does the loved one, that person, forge a connection when they can't always depend on who they're dealing with?
It's not easy. It's really not easy. And that's the first thing that we say. And as family members, we often have this unrelenting hope to help their loved one. And that's something that we really emphasize. You know, as family members, we have this spidey sense. When we see our loved one first thing in the morning, depending on how he sounds or how she sounds or how they sound, we can tell right away whether or not that person is grouchy, if they had a good night's sleep. As family members, we have this spidey sense in terms of knowing what helps our loved one through struggle. And so in CRAFT, we really talk about implementing other things in the community, in their environment, to help with some of the reasons why they go to substance use. So whether it's pain, whether it's emotional coping, ways to increase those positive reinforcers without using substances. And in doing so, you spend more time with your loved one, you increase that connection, you find more meaningful conversation between the two of you. And the hope is that by building those reinforcers and letting sometimes natural consequences of the substance use happen, that behavioral change down the road is possible.
Can you give us some examples of a scenario in which we could use a positive reinforcer when the first urge might be to say, I thought you were going to do X, Y, Z, and I can see you're not in a position to do that because of your substance use right now.
Mm-hmm.
What would a positive reinforcement be in that scenario?
A positive reinforcer is couched as something that brings joy to both the family member and the patient or the individual when substances aren't involved. So we talk about the things that they used to love doing together. Perhaps it's cooking a meal, eating wonderful foods together. It's about talking with their loved one that they would love to spend a meal together when they're not using substances. And letting them know that if they come home when the special dinner is planned and they are using, that they won't have special dinner together. And so it's a strategic timing of these positive reinforcers for when they aren't using. And the idea is to build that up in greater frequency.
And how to practically build up the positive part without sounding or appearing punitive when the family member takes away that opportunity because their loved one is using?
What a great question. And that's where the positive communication strategies come in. In learning craft, you learn to express yourself with compassion, sharing responsibility, offering loving words, and timing your conversation and your communication when the person is most likely to listen. And so you work on those positive communication strategies as well.
Is the success of craft based upon whether or not the loved one heals and stops using? I mean, is this a burden that family and friends will feel that if they work this program properly, they will affect a change in their loved one? And is that the ultimate proof of success?
What we share with our family members is that their loved one's substance use is out of our control. That even though we will do our best to change the environment, to say different communication, that ultimately that decision is up to them. The evidence shows that when family members go through craft, a significant portion of them will enter treatment, about two-thirds of them, when you compare it to traditional approaches like Al-Anon, Nar-Anon, and even the Johnson intervention. So it's successful in that way.
Their loved one will enter treatment?
Yes.
Ah.
Yes. Ideally, the goal would be for their loved one to enter treatment. Another great goal that Kraft talks about is decreasing their loved one's substance use. But also an underlying goal is improving the functioning of the family member, the depression, the pain, the anxiety, the anger that they experience themselves.
Yeah, it seems there's such a ball of emotions, different emotions that come together in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
If they loved us enough, as a parent, maybe, what did I do wrong?
Mm-hmm.
How could I have let this happen? Or just pure anger and frustration. That's a lot to sort and sift through.
It's a lot. And the self-blame is very prominent. And it's hard sometimes to understand why their loved one is doing all that when we have children, when we have a wonderful marriage at stake. It's tough for them to reconcile. And so oftentimes what happens is family members don't go to treatment. They don't seek therapy for themselves because of the shame, the embarrassment, the fear of being judged. And so oftentimes we call this a forgotten population because not only do we not talk about them as much, they're less likely to seek treatment than other people with other issues.
You know, sometimes toughness is equated with feeling like we're in control. We have some impact on a situation. Mm-hmm. And does it come up that it might feel like abdicating that to not be confrontational or not use tough love? Would I be giving away my power to say, well, okay, you're using today. I'm not going to make a make or break thing out of it, but I will look for a positive reinforcer later.
Mm-hmm.
How's that power shift?
I think when we're in pain, oftentimes we want to avoid the pain. And that's where the confrontation comes in. That's where the avoidance comes in. It's a sign of power when a family member says, I'm going to do something differently. I'm going to try something differently. I'm going to try to connect with them. When every ounce of my being says to avoid and to give them the cold shoulder.
How do family and friends get rid of that feeling that by not disapproving actively at any given moment, that they're actually giving their approval, giving away some of their power?
I think that's a common thought, that if you connect with the person with the problematic behaviors even more, you're endorsing or you're enabling or you're approving of the problems that they're engaging in. And to be clear, connecting with them doesn't mean that you're agreeing or liking the substance use that they're engaging with. But what it means is that you're putting aside just for a minute the strong feelings and judgments that often are associated with you reacting to the problem at hand. And the goal is to connect. It's to respond effectively and to do so in a way so that your loved one starts connecting with you too. And the hope is by increasing this connection that change could happen. Change in the family member and the way they approach their loved one, as well as their loved one and their substance use.
You are a doctor of psychology, a researcher, and you're also a clinician. So I'm going to ask you a two-part question about results.
Sure.
First, as the researcher, what does science, you touched on this before, but maybe more specifically, what does science tell you in your research that this positive approach is the right way to go? And then as a clinician, the human result of that. What have you seen in your real life interactions that drives your confidence in the CRAFT approach?
So I mentioned earlier that the evidence for CRAFT is quite strong. Family members who receive CRAFT tend to have loved ones that seek treatment, about two-thirds of them, when you compare them to other traditional approaches like Al-Anon, Ar-Anon, as well as the Johnson intervention. So science tells us that this compassionate way of interacting with our loved one works. We also have a study called INSPIRE, Integrating Support Persons into Recovery. And this is a research study that's ongoing. So far, we've recruited 400 family members and their loved ones. And these are loved ones that are in OUD treatment right now, in opioid use treatment right now. And what we're trying to better understand is this interaction between family members and patients. We've collected data from about 400 dyads to date. We don't have outcomes yet, but what we're seeing is this amazing interaction that we know from a human side of things matters. That when family members think a certain way, when they communicate in a certain way, it affects the patient. So my colleagues, Kat Namath, Lauren Lucet, Jasmine Choi, and Kevin Shaw have spent a lot of time looking at some baseline data for when family members have certain attitudes about medications for opioid use disorder. For example, when family members are very familiar with the treatment or they have supportive attitudes, that crosses over to the patient. Patients report improved mental health, less depression, less anxiety. They also report reduced overdose risk. So I think the science is beginning to tell us what we know from a human element, that when our village is on the same team with us, is supportive, that it influences the individual struggling with substance use as well.
You mentioned medication. We haven't talked about that yet.
Mm-hmm. CRAFT doesn't specifically focus on medication as it's a psychotherapy, it's a counseling program. But in our INSPIRE study, we've adapted CRAFT for patients who are already in treatment. And so what we emphasize in our sessions with our family members is that buprenorphine naloxone, a common medication for opioid use disorder, helps a lot of people with opioid use. In fact, it helps reduce significantly the risk of fatality associated with typical heroin or other opioid use. A lot of times family members will have misperceptions about medication. The common ones that medication is just swapping for other opioid use, that if the person is on medication, that they're not truly recovered. And these are myths that we talk about in our groups, because as I just mentioned, that when family members have more supportive attitudes to the treatments that their loved one is receiving, our hope is that in our outcomes data that we'll see that patients will want to stay on and indeed stay on treatment longer.
You know, part of the feeling of lack of power for families and friends is the desperate fear that their loved one is going to overdose and they're not going to be able to save them.
Yeah.
And the idea of a naloxone that can be had by family members, that can easily be available, that will save a life in seconds. I'm hoping that your research is showing that that attitude is changing, that this is a gift rather than something to be, I don't know, offended by or afraid of.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, it is a gift. Naloxone saves millions of lives. And we talk about naloxone education in our groups as well. When we looked at our baseline data, again, we have about 400 or so to date, we find that the majority of family members are coming in with supportive attitudes about naloxone, medications for OUD. So I think there is a shift in the field where we're better understanding how to help loved ones with opioid use disorder.
You mentioned the vast research going on with Kraft and the work of your lab. Where is this happening? Is this primarily in primary care clinics? Is it with private mental health providers?
Today, a lot of the Kraft studies have focused on community samples, so advertising to family members who are interested in seeking help for their loved one and testing whether or not community samples of family members benefit from Kraft. There has been a new push as the opioid use epidemic has come about in working with family members in clinical settings as well. And so there have been studies working with family members in mental health clinics. My study focuses on family members in primary care.
So is there a way for a family member, a friend who is dealing with this now to become involved? Do you have studies open for family members or ways for them to get into a Kraft program somewhere?
Absolutely. And they don't need to do it in the context of a research study. There are Kraft resources now that could help loved ones. There are books that Jane Ellen Smith and Robert Myers have published. There's like a self-help book called Getting Your Loved One Sober. The CMC Foundation for Change, Jeff Foote's group, offers a lot of Kraft resources, and he calls his program Invitation to Change. And so these are programs that offer self-help books, but also one-on-one counseling and groups for family members that are low cost. And finally, there are two other organizations that I would recommend. The Partnership to End Addiction does a lot of work for family members with children affected by addiction, as well as Smart Family and Friends that offers groups for family and friends who are struggling with similar issues.
Wonderful. This is a good opportunity for you to give a message, your personal message to family and friends who may be struggling with this. What would you tell them?
I think I would tell them that you're likely experiencing a lot of different emotions, from pain, anger, frustration, disappointment, or maybe you're just numb from all the years of strife that you've gone through. And I would want you to know that you're not alone. You're not alone. A lot of other people are struggling too, and that there is hope. There are resources available, and we've figured out ways to help you, whether it's self-help, whether it's online, whether it's in the office of a therapist. And if you find yourself in an office with a therapist who you think is just not the best fit for you, that's totally okay. We're human. I'm a therapist and I don't think I'm the best fit for everybody. Find somebody else. There might be somebody else that's a better fit for you, and that's okay.
Just don't give up.
Just don't give up.
I know you're not giving up. I know you continue your work. What is next in research for you in this area?
That's a great question, Jane. As I talk about Inspire and my current work with family members affected by OUD, a lot of people have come up to me asking about working with family members who have had a loss related to overdose. And so Allison Athey at the RAND Corporation and I received funding from the National Institutes of Health to work with family members experiencing overdose grief. And we're going to work with medical examiner offices to identify these next of kin and help provide these family members with support. So we're working with the peer support community partners, people who have lived experience grieving an overdose death, to offer peer support for these next of kin members. And my hope is that through this project, we'll learn more about the special grief this population experiences, how to help a population that tends to go hidden because of shame, guilt, and embarrassment, and how to empower them in ways that could help their recovery as well.
I hope you'll come back with that information.
I would love to. Would you invite me again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you so much for sharing it with us, Dr. Karen Osilla.
Thank you.
Repeating Dr. Osilla's comforting message, you are not alone. It's our sincere wish that hearing about her work, her commitment to expanding science-based treatments and accessible support has given you hope for a path forward. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Osilla and her work with CRAFT, check out the link in this episode's program notes. I'd like to say thank you once again to Dr. Karen Osilla, licensed clinical psychologist and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. And of course to you for joining us on What Makes Up Your Mind. Come back again. I'm Jane McMillan. You've been listening to What Makes Up Your Mind. Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health from the experts in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. For more information on this program and all of our transformational work, visit us at med.stanford.edu/psychiatry. What Makes Up Your Mind? Updates from the frontiers of neuroscience, well-being, and mental health is a production of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine, a copyright of the Board of Trustees of Stanford University.